This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. It is an off year for candidates, but there were some important things on the ballot. Texas voters yesterday deciding whether the state should add 17 new amendments to the state constitution, and they determined some funding questions for local school districts. KACU's Heather Claiborne brings us this look at the local outcome of the 2025 election.
15% of Taylor County's registered voters showed up this election, helping the rest of Texas to add 17 amendments to the state's constitution. All 17 had strong support in the county. The most popular measures, which got more than 90% of the vote, were related to homestead exemptions. Prop 7 sets up a homestead exemption for surviving spouses of veterans who die from a service-connected disease. Prop 10 provides a temporary homestead exemption for residents destroyed by fire. The closest votes across Taylor County were the questions about school funding. Abilene ISD Superintendent John Kuhn has spent the last few months explaining what was at stake for the district in Abilene's Proposition A. Today, he's celebrating after 54% of voters voted yes to Vader.
It's a measure of the morality of a society, what we're willing to do for our kids. And you know, I think educating children is really not optional. If we want our children to grow up and be healthy and strong and successful and happy and, you know, self-actualized and fulfilled, then we educate them. That has always taken resources, and it always will take resources. And so I'm super thrilled to know that the city of Abilene, Taylor County, Jones County, the voters went to the polls and said, yeah, we want to invest in our kids and in our future.
Now that the voters have approved the new tax rate, Abilene ISD will get a share of state funds that were not available without this vote. And even though the vote was to approve a tax increase, taxpayers will see a decrease in the school district portion of their property taxes because the Board of Trustees approved a cut to another piece of the property tax earlier this year.
The taxes compared to last year are going down, and yet it's going to generate an extra $10 million this year and every year to come. And almost two-thirds of that is not from the pockets of Abilene property taxpayers. It's a heck of a deal.
Those funds are set to arrive in the spring semester. Kuhn will survey district staff to get their input on priorities, and he'll have a plan ready for the board to consider early next semester so the district can put the dollars to work quickly. Texas first set up the two-tiered school funding system in 1989. Superintendent Kuhn says he thinks it's telling that Abilene is one of several districts to finally put this option in front of voters this year.
This current election around the state, lots and lots of schools have gone to the voters and asked for this. And I think that's a sign of just how tough things are right now financially for school districts with the state really not coming to our aid in the aftermath of the inflationary pressures that we've seen since COVID. You know, it's just, it's pretty tough right now financially for school districts.
Yesterday, Big Country voters also approved the Vader proposition for Jim Ned, as well as a $39 million bond for a new elementary school in Breckenridge and a $22 million bond in Merkel. It was a split decision for Baird ISD, which had two bond packages on the ballot. Voters approved a $25 million package to invest in renovations, additions, safety, and technology. But by just a two-vote margin, they rejected a $2.5 million package for teacher housing, a $171 million package for Snyder ISD, and a $22 million bond for HICO failed. All of these results are unofficial until election administrators finalize results in the coming weeks. I'm Heather Claiborne in Abilene.
With the federal government on pause, more families are now leaning in on community resources to get by. Here's Josiah Winnell with the anticipated increase in need at the West Central Texas Food Bank and its partners from across the big country.
The West Central Texas Food Bank is currently undergoing major construction, and the work doesn't stop there. Across 13 counties, food insecurity challenges thousands of big country households. This facility is the central nervous system for emergency aid in the region. The food bank functions as a critical distribution hub. Meeting that scale requires precise coordination across a vast territory, as Director of Operations Patrick Dimbach explains.
Currently, the food bank that's been in this location for approximately 43 years serves 13 counties surrounding Abilene, including Taylor's one of those 13, basically stretching along I-20 from Mitchell County in the west to Eastland and Comanche County in the east and southeast and a few either side.
The construction is a necessity for future capacity. Dimbach confirms the expansion will allow them to serve neighbors at a higher level.
As we open up our facility next year in 2026, we will then also be able to serve those folks, the neighbors in need, at that level.
The reality for many families is that a single setback can erase months of financial progress. Leah Woods waited in line at Abilene's Presbyterian Food Pantry Tuesday. She said she had only come a couple of times before, but Woods was actively working to move off public benefits when she hit a hurdle.
I'm just trying to level my life up. I'm on FSS program for the housing here in Abilene. And so I've gotten off benefits. I'm trying to step up, but I've recently lost my job. So, I mean, I'm having to come through here, you know, to get the...
Woods appreciates the generosity of the community in supporting the pantry that serves about 600 clients each month. It's just one of around a dozen food pantries in the city, and for many households, it supplements to fill the gap after families have used up their federal benefits. 3.5 million Texans receive SNAP benefits, or SNAP. Director of Programs for the Food Bank of West Central Texas, Summer Menchaca, explains how the program works.
SNAP stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. What that is it was previously called the Food Stamp Program. And a family can apply for this benefit, and if approved and eligible, they will receive a card that has preloaded benefits or funds on it each month to where they can go and purchase food items for their household.
While SNAP recipients spend those funds at retail locations, Patrick Dimbach clarifies that the food bank's operations are part of the Emergency Food Assistance Program.
The other food recipient benefits is through the TFAP program, which is the Emergency Food Assistance Program through the USDA and TDA administered.
Dimbach says the food bank and its partner agencies exist specifically to be ready to help families in crisis. And Sarah Machaca says the West Texas Food Pantry Network is the safety net, whether the crisis is caused by personal hardships,
economic volatility, or benefit changes.
So the food bank and our partner agencies, we stand ready to support that increase if that does in fact happen. And so amongst our distributions, we have the 13 mobile food pantries in our area, and they serve approximately 1,600 families each month.
Food bank services are designed not to cover all needs, but to act as a crucial temporary supplement. This definition governs the food bank's entire operational goal. Patrick Dimbach outlines why their mission is inherently about gap coverage.
All these programs are meant to be supplemental assistance programs, not filling the entire household for a month. So you also have to find as many resources as you possibly can in order to fill the gap that you're experiencing at any given time.
The logistical challenge finds its human face at the local distribution points, where volunteers manage the flow of food to community members. These mobile pantry sites represent the final delivery stage of the emergency food network. The sheer necessity of these multiple resources underscores the vulnerability of many residents. Leah Woods says the quality of the food provided by the network is often the difference between a family being able to prepare a decent meal or not.
I mean, the food they give you is, I mean, very, very good. I mean, it's definitely a meal that you can make, and it'll last you for, you know, a good week.
When the cost of electricity, gasoline, and housing strains household budgets, the grocery bill is often the first thing to be cut. This network serves as the last line of defense, providing immediate relief when a family is forced to make impossible choices between paying rent and buying food. The missed payments create an extra layer of stress for families that count on benefits to feed those families. But oftentimes, those who receive SNAP benefits find the aid isn't enough. Margaret Walker waited in line at the Presbyterian Food Pantry with her friend Danny Lamond. Margaret said her granddaughter is really feeling the loss of her $700 in SNAP benefits to feed her family. But she said she knows Danny can't truly rely on it as steady help each month.
He gets $85 a month. That's one or two trips to the store. I cry when I want it, but I have to go shop.
Some people get as low as some $20, that's $20, so some people get as low as much as $1,000 or $2,000 a month.
For those on a fixed income, even a small, consistent amount of assistance from the local pantry can be a lifeline. Danny Lamond says this is evident in his life.
It helps with the economy. It just helps out. When you're on a fixed income, it helps. Stuff like this helps.
Lamond made sure to show up in time for the beginning of the pantry's holiday food items, like a frozen turkey for Thanksgiving. For households living with food insecurity, the pressure is being compounded by high food prices this year. Patrick Dimbach says it creates a triple pressure point on community resources as the holidays approach. Dimbach says the food bank depends on public support to manage this surge.
And so if you're out there listening to this and you are aware of what's going on around you with the government, the holidays, and just the general price increases at the retail level, to help your neighbors, support your local food bank, your local food pantry. It can be through volunteerism, it can be monetary, or it can be just products themselves.
We want to ensure that not one person in our community goes hungry. I mean, that's something that we want to help alleviate.
As the government shutdown continues and officials navigate rulings on whether emergency funds should be used to supply benefits, the West Central Texas Food Bank will continue to distribute hundreds of thousands of pounds of food weekly, functioning not just as a safety net, but as an essential pillar of the regional economy. I'm Josiah Winnell in Abilene.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. Beef, it's what's for dinner. That's a marketing statement from the early 90s, but for many of us in West Texas, it's just the truth. Certainly on the West Texas Dispatch, we've talked about the prices of beef, how that affects consumers. Today, we thought we'd learn more about how this affects one of West Texas' biggest industries, cattle producers. Sam Snyder, he is a board member with the Texas Farm Bureau. He is a rancher in Callahan and Shackelford counties, and he has taken some time from his day to join us here on the West Texas Dispatch. Sam, thank you.
It's a pleasure being here. Thank you for letting me talk to you.
Well, I'm going to start with a broad question, and that is, what is it like out there for cattle producers right now?
Right now, things are really good price-wise. They really are. Drought, we could use the rain. I mean, Abilene and the big country needs rain. We're not that wet. And you need that to sustain your herd. You know, there's a lot of factors that go into whether you're having, as a rancher, a good day or a bad day. You know, when somebody says something overseas and the market goes locked down the limit, that's a bad day, which has happened recently. But it's a good time to be in agriculture. It's a good time to be a cattle rancher. You know, the row crops aren't doing that great because of prices. The cattle are, thank goodness. I'm blessed to be in this industry. It's the only thing I've ever done. We've been on our ranch for 142 years.
Wow.
In Shackford and Callahan County. And I grew up on a ranch. I still run a lot of the original ranch, plus lease a lot of country. And I'm glad I'm in the business I am. It's very satisfying.
Sam, the question I was going to ask you next was, what's your biggest concern? But it sounds like for cattle producers out there, rain is still like the biggest single concern you have.
Always. And weather is one of the problems that cattle prices are so high now, because we've been in a drought actually for 25 years, honestly. One or two wet years didn't break a drought. And you know, the lake levels, you know, we filled them up a little bit, but boy, they're getting low again. And so where we are in our area, it's always weather and always rain. So that's what is our biggest concern. You know, markets, yeah, you like high prices and everything. Regulations, yeah, you like to be friendly with the regulations to your producers, that we got to be able to do what we do. But yeah, the weather is by far the biggest factor in whether you're having a good year or a bad year.
Well, you talked about it earlier, than that is the diminishing number of cattle that are out there right now for consumers to purchase, and that drives up the price. Do you see that fixing itself? Do you see more cattle entering the country and West Texas in particular?
It's not a quick fix, because we have the lowest numbers that we've had, like in nationwide numbers, in 70 years, something like that. And building a herd isn't like stocking groceries on a shelf, you know. You've got to save back heifers, or you got to buy heifers or buy cows. And then if you have a calf on the ground, it's 3 or 4 years for, if it's a heifer calf, that's 3 or 4 years before she'll have a calf. So it's nothing instantaneous at all. And you got to realize if somebody says, well, we need to grow a herd, that's fine. But cows right now are very expensive to buy. So if you buy at a high price and the market really settles down because of supply and demand, then you're looking at a pretty big loss hickey there. And so it's a lot of factors. It's not an easy fix. It's not a quick fix is all I can say.
We were talking about prices being high. And obviously, yep. if you're at the auction and you were selling your cattle, that's what you want. But yep. We just talked about fixing the herd, and you're going to have to buy cattle to do it. And prices are through the roof right now. Sounds yep. like it's a two-edged sword.
It's very much a two-edged sword. And the thing about it is these high prices are unprecedented. They need to stay in the area of where they are now because the last 4 or 5 years, the inputs to our business has been unprecedentedly high. I mean, inflation, interest, $4 and $5 diesel, feed cost, I mean, insurance cost, whatever, anything that we've had since COVID or before, it's just been over the top expensive for us to do, to stay in business. Mm-hmm. I mean, we make a lot of money, but boy, I tell you what, we spend a lot of money to stay in business. And a lot of people, when it was so dry, like 2011, I went through all of it. And then here recently, when it got real dry, you're spending money hand over fist just to keep your herd going because there's a lot of people sold out, George, a lot, and just said, well, to heck with it. You know, it's just too much of a burden. Those that stayed in the business, borrowed money, had money to keep the herd up and feed them nearly every bite they had, they're reaping the benefits. But it's going to take 2 or 3 more years of really good prices for everybody to get back to even. There's a lot of people and a lot of debt out there, the people that really produce food. I'm not talking about, you know, weekend ranchers or farmers. I'm talking about the people that make a living at it.
And have been doing it for 150 years.
Forever. Like your family. Yes, yes.
Every time we talk to economists on this show, we hear the same thing, which is we want to have some stability, some sustainability, so that they can make predictions and understand the markets.
Yes.
And it sounds like the cattle business is very volatile. Are you hearing that from the constituents?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's very volatile. And it's hard to make plans. It is so scary. Somebody's been in business for as long as I have. And you see prices get up to where they've never been. You know, somebody opens their mouth or does something overseas, whatever, and the market just tanks for no reason. There's a lot of money that's been lost in the futures market. And the cash market here in the last 2 weeks is down $30 to $50 a hundredweight. $50 times a 700-pound steer, you're talking a little bit of money. That's your profit, you see. Mm-hmm. So it stability, when you know that you raise a calf now, and by the time you sell it, you're going to be in good shape price-wise, man, that's worth a lot.
Well, you talk about stability and you talk about, news affecting it. You said, yep. You know, someone internationally, and we know that a lot of money is being spent right now on Argentinian beef cattle being brought up here. Are you hearing from your constituents on that?
Well, absolutely. The Argentina thing, you know, when the president said we're going to, you know, import more Argentinian beef, and that's just a drop in the bucket. It mm-hmm. shouldn't affect the market that much. They don't bring in live cattle here from it. It's processed cattle, and it's mostly for the grind, which is hamburger meat, which is, because the prices of meat are so high, that's the most popular meat now. It's hamburger meat, of course. Wow. I mean, that, you know, but those cattle coming from Argentina are probably just for the grind, and I don't think it's going to matter one way or another much on our markets.
One of the other issues we wanted to talk about, and we did a piece recently here on the West Texas Dispatch, is this New World screwworm. That's got to be on your radar as well. Oh, what are you hearing?
I remember the day that I heard back in November, I believe, that the screwworm, and I was born in 1953. And so I was just a kid. I didn't rope calves and doctor them, but I rode in the pickup and watched my dad and his uncles do it. And it brought fear to my heart. A rancher, you want to send him to his knees, just say screw worm. Anybody who knows what it is just terrified of it. And that's huge, George. It's huge. Let us hope that we don't get back where we were in the 50s, because a screw worm can be devastating. It can be much worse than anybody now realizes, because when it gets here, there's not much you can do about it. I mean, it's really hard to keep your cattle doctored and make sure they don't get the larvae and start eating away at them. And it gets the wildlife, it gets everything. It's devastating. And with Texas Farm Bureau, we started back in April when we went to Washington, D.C. We made sure all these people knew that it was coming, and it was terrible. Not that many people, congressmen, knew about it. They really didn't, or senators. No. But we let them know. We had a full-court press and let them know. And so we're going in the right direction. But things in government are slow. Just like the cattle market, change in building facilities to have sterile flies, that's how you get rid of them. And it takes years to get a sterile fly facility and a swarm of flies that are sterile and you sterilize them. I mean, it takes a while. So it's not a quick fix like you spray them with something. No, that's not it. But screw worms, they're not here yet, we don't think. But we don't know for sure how far they are up in Mexico, because they're not, Mexico isn't giving us very good information on where they are in Mexico. But when and if they come, it's going to be front page news.
Wow. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been a hoot.
Sam Snyder is a rancher in Callahan and Shackelford counties, a board member for the Texas Farm Bureau, and he's talking to us about the cattle business in West Texas. This is the West Texas Dispatch. If you've noticed more chirping at night lately, you're not imagining it. Around this time of year, crickets are out in full force across the big country, and they're trying to keep you up at night. KACU's Alexis Jones sat down with Steve Estes from the Big Country Master Naturalists to find out why their numbers spike each fall and what you can do to keep the noisy visitors from taking over.
Okay, Steve. So can you just start by kind of explaining, around this time of year, we start to notice a bunch of crickets just in our offices, in our homes, in the lights, you know? Can you explain, like, where they come from and why they're here?
So crickets are, and similar to grasshoppers as well, is they lay eggs, and they lay their eggs in the fall and over winter, and then they'll hatch out the following year. And what's interesting is they can hatch out all through the summer, but hence you may have seen some few crickets here and there. Mm-hmm. But it's typically we get into the fall time frame, especially a dry fall and mild like time frame that we have now, that we see kind of an abundance of them hatching out. And then we feel like we're kind of inundated with crickets all of a sudden, and we wonder where they came from. And basically what it boils down to is just a recent big hatch because the weather conditions were just right.
Yeah. So how long do crickets usually live? What's their lifespan looking like?
So these crickets now, they'll be out, and then the life cycle's kind of starting over. They're out and about, and then they'll be laying eggs and for next year's crickets, if you will. Mm-hmm. So their lifestyle just this 1 year, and then, of course, the eggs, new eggs will hatch next year.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about certain conditions make it to where these eggs hatch. What do those conditions look like?
Well, kind of like right now, we're having a mild fall. We're not having we haven't had any really cold weather just yet per se that would slow the development of the crickets. So, in typically you can also look as in such with your crickets, and then I mentioned earlier about. Somewhat similar to grasshoppers, the mild fall time frame is conducive for egg laying, and then egg laying, like I said, it goes through the winter time, or the eggs do. They overwinter, then they'll hatch out the following year. If we have like different weather patterns in the fall, like it's really rainy or cold or whatnot, that disrupts that egg laying process,
mm-hmm.
and which would mean less numbers for the following year.
For people that feel like they're kind of drowning in the numbers right now, what can they do to prevent them or to just keep them out of the house?
Well, as far as right now, you just kind of basically have to in a sense, put up with them, but it should be short-lived.
Right.
You know, the outbreak of what you're seeing around the house, probably, you know, within a week or two, and then you'll see the numbers really taper off. So what we're seeing is a cycle of a bunch that have hatched out all about the same time frame.
Well, thank you for talking to me, Steve.
All right, you bet.
The seasons are finally changing here in Abilene, so we talked to Austin King and Adam Andrews at Willow Creek Gardens to get the lowdown on how to prepare your plants for that temperature change, from what kind of fertilizer to use to when the coldest months may be. KACU's Jordan Herrick reports.
It's officially autumn here in West Texas, and the temperatures are finally starting to show signs of dropping. Fall can be a difficult time for beginner and advanced gardeners alike, so how can you prepare your plants for the transition into the cold winter months? According to Austin King from Willow Creek Gardens, choosing the right fertilizer is a good first step.
You'll want to do a fertilizer that's geared for root growth, because that's where the tree stores all its energy and everything, and, you know, a healthier root system, healthier tree, shrub, flower, whatever.
For some plants, fall is the time for them to start going dormant.
Flame acanthus, hardy hibiscus, and a couple others. They grow out for the season, you know, they do all green and everything. And then the fall time, and then when we get our first few freezes, they die back, and you just let them.
But this is not the case for all plants. Tropical plants are much more sensitive to change in temperature and may need to be brought inside during freezes and cold snaps.
We have an orange tree that we keep out in a pot, and we have to bring that inside whenever it freezes. Because citrus and orange trees do not care for cold weather. That's why you see them planted in the ground in places like Florida.
These types of plants originate from more temperate climates that don't experience the same drastic change in seasons like we have here in West Texas.
Believe it or not, there are some tropical plants that if you have them by a back door and you keep open, you know, kids are coming in and out or dogs or something, that cold blast will affect a tropical. So that, and keeping them away from fireplaces if you light a fire, because that heat. So tropicals like it very even geo temperature.
If you plan on bringing outdoor plants inside for the winter, you may be bringing in the outside with them.
Bringing in any patio plants or anything like that, tropicals that you had outside for a warm season, dosing them with a systemic insecticide, which will prevent, you know, soil gnats from coming out, or, you know, anything that might have been outside from getting inside your house.
But if you're looking to add a new plant to your outdoor collection, there are other options that not just survive the season, but thrive in it.
Right now is the perfect time for pansies, which are nice little annual flower. They're really cold hardy. They're pretty. They come in so many different colors. And they're pretty easy to take care of.
According to Adam Andrews, the owner of Willow Creek Gardens, it's time to refresh your flower beds.
Remulch your beds, add mulch, you know, to help protect perennials and plants like that.
And for the plants that are staying outside this season, there are a few extra precautions you can take to fend off the freeze.
Freeze cloth, put it on the plant, you just wrap it. Some people do plastic, but I don't recommend that because moisture can be trapped against the plastic and on the leaves and it can rot. But the freeze cloth lets it breathe a little bit.
According to Adam Andrews, the owner of Willow Creek Gardens, cleaning up newly fallen leaves is another important step to take.
Leaf cleanups are important. Believe it or not, leaves do not create insulation on the yard like some people think. Actually, what can happen is, number one, you're covering your lawn, which needs sunlight. Number two, if those leaves can start to mildew a little bit and create a haven for insects and mold and mildew and disease and things like that.
And different types of grass lawns need new watering schedules this winter.
Another thing is, it's time to change the sprinkler system in your yard. Go to a winter type, which is every 2 weeks of watering. If you have St. Augustine lawns, you want to not turn your sprinkler off completely. It does need water through the winter months, not near what it does during the summer, but obviously it needs some moisture. It doesn't go truly dormant here.
Although the Old Farmer's Almanac predicts the 2025-2026 winter to be on the dry and mild side, experts suggest that year-round maintenance is the key to making the best of each season. I'm Jordan Herrick in Abilene.
This week on West Texas Roots, we talked to the owner of the Texas Star Trading Company, Glenn Dromgoole, about how the Texas store was started and how he became the author of such books as What Dogs Teach Us and I'd Rather Be Fishing.
We started it in 2004, over 20 years. We started a little shop down by the Paramount Theater and then moved to a larger space where we are now at 2nd and Cypress. About two, three years after that. So we've been there 18 years and hope to be there a while longer. I was retired from the newspaper. I had been the editor of the paper. And so I was writing a column for some other newspapers on Texas books. It was a weekly column. And so I kind of got to know the Texas book scene pretty well. And I was also, at the time, I was chairing a book festival here. And so I had a lot of contacts with Texas authors, and my wife Carol had done a sales rep for some book and gift lines where she went around to stores all over West Texas and sold stuff to them. And so we just decided to put two interests together and open this store. Abilene Bookstore had been in the place where we are now, and they had closed earlier in 2004. And so there was we thought there was a market there, and particularly to focus on Texas books. So when we started, we just focused on Texas books and not much else. And then after we moved down to where we are now, we were able to add a lot of other things. So now we have Texas gourmet and gifts and T-shirts and souvenirs and what all that we didn't do when we first started. So we first started strictly as a bookstore and then kind of expanded into other things as we went along. I was the editor of the Abilene Porter. What brought me to town, I came here in 1985 to be the editor of the paper, and I did that for 12 years, and then decided I'd want to try something else. Well, what the something else turned out to be was books. And I started writing books. I've written about 35 maybe. My first book was called What Dogs Teach Us, and it was just a little gift book for people that like dogs, and it had little one-liners. And then the publisher got really nice pictures to go with it. And it was published by a little publisher in Wisconsin that specialized in pets and outdoor books. And so they published my book. It had been rejected, by the way, by about 15 other publishers earlier. And finally they said, yeah, they'd publish it. And it gave me a little royalty advance on it. And I thought, well, it'd be nice. I'll have a little book. Well, what they did is they made a deal with Barnes & Noble to put it on their $20 and under gift table at Christmas, and it went to number 24 on the New York Times bestseller list. So my first book was kind of a big deal, and I've never had another one on the bestseller list. That was my only one. But that kind of opened up a lot of things, and I was able to write some other gift book things like that, and then some books having to do with West Texas and Texas, Abilene and that sort. I have a book called West Texas Stories and one West Texas Christmas Stories that I pulled together from other writers. You know, it was an anthology kind of a thing. And then Jay Moore and I put together, and Joe Speck, we put together a book called Abilene Stories that had done really, really well. There hadn't been anything much written about Abilene in any Texas collections or anything. And so we started working on it, and we put together a really good book. We had about 100 stories from about 70 different writers, and it really hit the market just right. And it came out in 2013. And since then, Jay's written several other books. I've written several other books, but I also wrote a book called, I'd Rather Be Fishing, and it was just a little collection of little short thoughts about fishing and how it related to life and that kind of thing. I'd written it originally as a newspaper column many years ago after a fishing trip with my daughter, Janet, who was 11. And after we came back from that fishing trip, I wrote this column.
This is the West Texas Dispatch. It might still be weeks before Thanksgiving, but if you've already spotted Christmas lights twinkling around town, you're not alone. Every year, the holiday season seems to start just a little earlier. And while many in the big country are taking in the early glow, local organizations are using the Head Start to remind the community what they say this season is truly about, the spirit of giving. KACU's Alexis Jones has more.
At the Abilene Convention Center, volunteers are busy setting up what's become one of the city's earliest signs of Christmas, the Junior League's Christmas Carousel.
So Christmas Carousel is our biggest fundraiser of the year. It helps fund all of our projects for the year. So this is a vendor market. We do charge admission. The reason we do that, that's part of our earnings that go back into the community. And it helps support some of our projects like care packs for kids. And that's shelf-stable food that we provide at schools for kids that might not be able to have any meals over the weekend.
That's Sam Townsend, this year's Christmas Carousel chair. She says the early start, even before Thanksgiving, isn't about skipping holidays. It's about giving people a head start on celebrating and giving back.
We like to do it earlier just because it gives people a head start on shopping for Christmas. And it also works out, I think, better for our merchants just because they're able to get away from their brick and mortars for a little bit and not during like their super busy time.
The Christmas Carousel is packed with local and out-of-town vendors. Everything from clothes to books to coffee and snacks. And every dollar spent at the event helps fund community programs. Townsend said those include hygiene kits for teens, meals for students, and support for youth experiencing homelessness.
Oh, especially well this year, you know, it's been hard on a lot of folks. A lot of folks are furloughed and stuff. And this year, you know, you just see that need in the community where some folks, you know, might not have as much as others or might not even have clothes, you know, for the winter. So it's crazy to think that, you know, how blessed some of us are.
Townsend says the event's theme this year, Rocking Around the Christmas Tree, is more than just decor.
So it all goes back into the community, into our projects that we support in our in the local community. So like I said, care packs for kids, Sud Buds, homeless youth is another one. We also have Feeding Bright Futures, which is formerly Kids in the Kitchen.
The Christmas Carousel includes a style show, a raffle, and even brunch with Santa, where kids can craft, eat breakfast, and hear a Christmas story. But the highlight, Townsend said, is seeing the difference the event makes.
So I actually used to deliver care packs for kids myself, but I'd love it when I walked into the school and everybody would wave and say thank you, or even some of the kiddos recognized the care packs. Hey, care packs are here. And it was just such a positive experience. You know, I hate the fact that, you know, some people do need that assistance, but I'm so happy that organizations like Junior League and Love and Care Ministries are here to help provide.
And it's not just the Junior League getting into the early start on the season. Across town, the Salvation Army of Abilene is already kicking off with its annual Angel Tree campaign, one of the city's most visible signs of the Christmas spirit.
Our Angel Tree kickoff, which we're having at First Financial Bank on November 6th at 10 a.m., is just a collaboration with First Financial and the Salvation Army of Abilene. We have our Salvation Army band come out and play a few songs. The representative from First Financial Bank will come out and say a few words, followed by our major. Then the pulling of our first Angel Tree tag from the Angel Tree. And that's it. That's how we kick off the Angel Tree kickoff. Right.
That's Andre Gwynn with the Salvation Army of Abilene. He says Angel Tree programs help make Christmas possible for hundreds of local families.
Those Angel Tree tags are just Christmas wish lists of children throughout the city of Abilene that the parents have submitted applications to have their child be put on the Angel Tree program so that they have the opportunity to get Christmas items like toys or clothes, things that you know, most kids ask for around the holiday season.
Last year, the Salvation Army served about 750 families through the Angel Tree program. Andre says this year, the number could be even higher.
With the nature of how things have been unfolding with the government shutdown and whatnot, we do know that there's more families in dire need of certain services and resources. So the earlier we can get on some of these things, the better. That way we know how much at the end we still need. And that also helps prepare for the next year should we have these type of issues arise.
Andre remembers one child in particular, a young boy who asked for a Spider-Man bedding set.
So that really, like, it really brightened that child's, you know, demeanor in his face, and him being excited that he that the full
bedding set was going to be part of his Christmas experience. That's what makes those type of situations, those scenarios, fully worth what we do and what the community does with us to help provide for these children for the holiday season.
Andre says the need isn't just about presents. It's about dignity, stability, and compassion.
You know, because we all need to lift each other up. Just because it's happening across town doesn't mean it's not affecting you somewhere down the road. And I think we really should be more cognitive of how our community is affected by decisions that are made that are beyond our control, that affect the most vulnerable parts of our population. And it takes the community to really support us all and make sure that we try to give each other as much as we can to help lift each other up, to help satisfy those human needs that people have, because a lot of that we take for granted.
The Salvation Army's Red Kettle campaign, those iconic bell ringers outside local stores, will begin on Black Friday. And volunteers are still needed to ring the bells or serve at the organization's Thanksgiving meal later this month.
So people who want to volunteer to come out and ring the bell for our Red Kettle campaign, they can go to registertoring.com. All of the locations that are out there, all of the schedules are already out there, so they can just really just plug and play and they can sign up to come out and ring that bell. Because not, you know, monetary donations help, but also time, people's time is just as valuable, if not more valuable, when people come out and volunteer for our efforts and our campaign. So register to ring, come out and ring that bell. We have our Christmas kickoff that's going to be at Tulsi Live November 6th at 6 p.m. So we have our Angel Tree kickoff at 10 a.m. November 6th. And then we have our Christmas kickoff November 6th at 6 p.m. So it's a full day. We have a full day of events going. It'll be a fantastic night of live music, live auction, food, and networking community.
So while lights are going up earlier and Christmas songs are starting to play sooner, the heart behind it might just be stronger than ever. I'm Alexis Jones in Abilene.
This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon, and we want you to join us and tell all your friends. The West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find it on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from producers Heather Claiborne and Alexis Jones, and our digital editor, Calvin Claiborne. We also say farewell to Alexis this week. Alexis has been integral in getting the West Texas Dispatch and KACU's oral history project, West Texas Roots, off the ground. We're thankful for the excellent reporting she's brought to our show. We wish her all the best as she heads east to help the team at KERA in Dallas. Good luck, Alexis. I'm George Levesque.